Hello and welcome to the review of Game Week 7 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for listening. During a weekend where we finally saw Manchester City lose in the Premier League to now second place Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal and Liverpool all picked up 3 points. Yet, many of us will point out the flaws in their games while we analyze them. Whereas Manchester United, on the back of arguably their best performance of the season, dropped points against Stoke. As Sir Alex used to say, football, bloody hell. In order to discuss all of the games from this weekend, I am joined by the wonderful duo of Morgan Green and Kristen Henoch. Welcome, gentlemen. We're going to start part one with a question this time. It comes from Carlos Zaldivar, and it's my favorite question we got this week. The question, gentlemen, is, if the three of us became managers of our respective clubs, what would we do during our first week? And then what would it be like at the end of the season as well? So let's start with you, Morgan. What would you do in your first week as manager of Chelsea? And then what would you do in your first season?
See, I feel kind of, ashamed. I mean, I have so much privilege as the manager of Chelsea. My first week, I would probably get the boys back into shape, you know, do a training regimen.
Oh my.
And then I'd probably end up taking Eden Hazard out for a couple of hamburgers. I hear he likes those just to keep him happy because you want him happy and creative. I'd probably start working on a device to fire Branislav Ivanovic into the sun at this point. At the end of the first season, we would no doubt be champions by at least 15 points.
The good news is you're always realistic, Morgan. That's what we love about you. What about you, Chris? Newcastle United, what would you do your first week and your first season?
Besides drink heavily.
Right.
Nailed it. Absolutely. First week, just drink morning, noon, and night.
First season as well.
First season, I mean, yeah, no one, if it caused the weather, most Newcastle-related dreams of mine do, it'll probably involve heavy drinking. In terms of actual management, I would... See, we're not, this sounds bizarre, but we're actually not doing anything wrong at the minute. There's nothing catastrophic where I'm like, this needs to change. Everything is going fairly well. So I don't think I would change anything. I think I would leave it exactly as it is.
Do you think you would get Newcastle promoted?
I like to think I would get them promoted. I think the decisions are all relatively easy at this precise moment because of how good the squad is and where its strengths lie. I would probably try and bring an American over at some point. See if we couldn't loan Jordan Morris for 2 months, just, you know, marketing and stuff. That would be fun. Other than that, I don't know. Yeah, it sounds very bizarre to say because usually I've got a real rap sheet of stuff that I want to change about my football club. But at this precise moment, I am genuinely happy with the direction that it is heading in for the first time.
I got to say, the first thing, if I was Newcastle United, I would go on a fact rant just to replace Benitez, because you can't be replacing Benitez and not do a fact rant and talk about how the championship referees are all against Newcastle United. What would I do as Manchester United manager? First week, I would just go around meeting everybody and just be starstruck. Meet Sir Alex, meet Sir Bobby, meet the class of 92, take lots of pictures, and then I'd get down to work. Sign Christian Pulisic from Dortmund for probably about £300 million is probably what we'll have to pay for him at this point. And then get us relegated, because that's what would happen if I was manager.
That sounds absolutely right.
Of Manchester United. Speaking of relegation battles, let's talk about Tottenham and Manchester City. That is the worst transition and has nothing to do with reality, but I just wanted to throw it in there. Tottenham beat Man City 2-0. Chris, last week we talked about, you and I struggled to find flaws in the Manchester City system, and here we are. Pochettino found a few of them. The big one that I noticed, at least, was what they did in midfield. There were runs from deep, and there was a lot of strength in midfield. Wanyama was putting a lot of pressure, as well as throwing in tackles. He got the yellow card. It was actually the performance I expected Pogba and Fellaini to have against Manchester City. But we saw Tottenham deliver that strength in midfield and those runs from deep that the likes of Fernando had trouble keeping up with.
It was the pressure. It was consistently the pressure that told. I mean, you look at Eriksen, for example. He had 16 ball recoveries. That's your attacking midfielder performing on a defensive end. That's, in that sense, it was such a holistic performance from Tottenham, because they were efficient and so much more in the sense of, we talk about why you press high and it's with the intention of starting an attack quickly while your opponent is disorientated. I don't think it was as simple as they pressed them high. I think what they did was they managed to act aggressively, but also with composure. It very rarely for me bled over into recklessness or anything like that. And I think when you can perform in that way, then you have a fantastic chance of unsettling City, because too often with the speed of the way that the ball moves and the teams under Guardiola play, it can be very easy, I think, to lunge in, to make silly tackles, to collect those silly yellow cards that lead into reds and ultimately give City the advantage. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that with Tottenham. I saw a very polished performance. And granted, Pochettino's had significantly longer with this team than Guardiola has had with his.
Right.
And I think we have to cut him some degree of slack with that. I would also add to that that I think this performance cements that Tottenham are title challengers at this point. They're a team that could legitimately do better than last year, which when we look at how much of last season looked like this weird sort of blip on the radar and the kind of the numbers and everything like that with Leicester winning it, that's a huge compliment.
Absolutely. It was really until that Tottenham-Leicester game, which was maybe four or five games from the end of the season, that Tottenham were the only real challengers for Leicester. Even though Arsenal finished above them, as Karthik points out, it was Tottenham that challenged, really only challenged Leicester for the title. So I agree with a lot what you said, and especially the bit about Guardiola having less time and Pochettino having more time. And I think Guardiola, who was incredibly complimentary towards Tottenham and to Pochettino in his post-match press conference, pointed out as much. Morgan, we'll get to Tottenham a little bit more here in a second, but switching to Manchester City, Kevin De Bruyne has been a huge miss. We saw what a terrific start he had to the season. He really links up that midfield and that forward line from the defense. He was involved in the build-up for all their goals. How much are they missing him right now?
They're missing him a lot. It's not shocking that the team's most creative player not being there is having a huge impact on them. Yeah. I think, and that's really, to me at least, he seems like that one outlet for Claudio Bravo. When they do go back to the goalkeeper and they send it to him and allow him to spread the ball out, he's that one kind of safety blanket that he knows if he can get it to De Bruyne can do a turn, do a quick pass, and he can get out of it. He seems to have the skill to do that without having that outlet there. Because, and again, we've seen that when they've done their breaks, you know, it gets to De Bruyne, he starts the triangle, and then everybody goes, and it's fun to watch, and it looks mm-hmm. great. Without that security blanket there, it almost seemed to me like Claudio Bravo was overthinking it. He didn't have the one guy that he could go to, or he didn't have a lot of options. And you could put that down to Tottenham's pressing as well. They took away the passing lanes. They were covering all of those guys, or at least, you know, if they were leaving one guy available to him, it was too close to the goalkeeper to really make any difference in the attacks. So you saw kind of those faux counterattacks that Manchester City likes to do mm-hmm. really kind of peter out.
And Chris, we talked about Son a little bit last week, and he had an assist in this game. I had another good game in the absence of Harry Kane. Janssen did not start. He came off the bench. We didn't talk enough about Tottenham's defense this year. It was a topic of conversation last year, but I'm thinking out loud right now. Can you think of a better, more cogent, well-drilled, well-organized back five than Lloris, Walker, Vertonghen, Alderweireld, and Danny Rose in all of Europe?
I'm hard pressed to do so. Mm-hmm. I think what you can say about their kind of situation is it highlights why if you can have a consistency in lineup, that can be so influential in terms of breeding a tight defense. Because I think if you were to perhaps say, is Danny Rose the best left back in Europe? Are they as individuals the best in their position?
Exactly.
You would argue maybe not. They're definitely near the top, of course,
yeah.
But they're not the best. It's when you put them together and you give them the stability of playing together week in, week out, building that understanding, and also having a style of play that I think is very beneficial towards the defense because it applies defensive responsibility to every single player. Mm-hmm. There's no one in that team ambling around not doing work. And in fact, it's had a benefit on some of the attackers. Even you look at Eric Lamela, the structure has made him a better player in kind of the latter part of his Tottenham career. So I think you're completely right in saying at the minute, it doesn't look as if there is a better back four or back five even. And I think you just look at the numbers. If I remember correctly, they've only conceded three this season and none from open play. Mm-hmm. That to me typifies just how good they are. And I think it backs up exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, to add to that, they've bought Wanyama, who might go down as one of the signings of the season so far. He's had a terrific start to the season. I think I said on World Soccer Talk and on other podcasts that I think Arsenal lost the opportunity to win the Premier League when they didn't even bid for Wanyama at 13 million. But we'll get to Arsenal later. A couple of questions. Morgan, let's start with you. Robert asks a question. Is Spurs' good start due to not having Thursday Europa League games?
I mean, I would say no, mainly because they have Wednesday Champions League games now.
But isn't that the argument of, you know, we often hear this argument, right, Morgan? Thursday to Saturday, yeah, or Thursday to Sunday is way more difficult than Wednesday to Saturday. It changes the rhythm. You have to change which days you have off, all that stuff.
Well, and I understand the argument that you want to come up with that because it is obviously closer to Saturday on there, but you're talking about a one-day difference. And, you know, if you're still traveling from somewhere, say Spurs had to play in Russia this year, mm-hmm, on, you know, in the Champions League, well, you automatically right there, you're losing that Thursday anyways. So, you know, I think that, yes, it does have it will have a little bit of an effect, but I don't think it's going to be as pronounced as it was, you know, as it has been in the past few seasons when Spurs were in the Europa League. You know, I mean, you saw everything they did last year. Did they have were they in Europa League last year?
Yes.
If I remember right. So, I mean, they ended up finishing second Europa League last year. Their collapse, I don't think, really kind of came down to the fact that they were playing in Europa League. So, I mean, I think it does have an effect on certain teams, as we do hear about the Champions League hangover as well. But I don't think it's going to be, I don't think that, you know, this good start is due to the fact that they're not playing in Europa League. I think that they're a team, much like Liverpool, mm-hmm, that was always going to come out of the blocks hot.
Chris, Nick Morales, friend of, you've done Front Three with him. I've done ULF with him. Great guy. Asks a good question here. Tactically, do you think Guardiola is capable of playing a style outside of heavy possession?
I don't know, because he's never had to. Hmm. He's had such success with the style that he plays. There's been little need for real deviation from that. And I think in some regards, that could be an interesting case study this summer and that's why it's such a great question from Nick, because the De Bruyne injury aside, I think it's fair to say that there's a good number of these players, not even so much that they're not Guardiola players, mm-hmm, as much as they're players that we've known for a while are, mm-hmm, not conducive to success for Manchester City and are much closer to being pushed out than being kept long term. Now, he managed to move some of those players on in the summer, the likes of Sami Nasri is a good example. There are still those that remain, though. I think Alexander Kolarov is likely one of them. He was certainly someone that was not scapegoated as much as blamed heavily today. So he's going to have to work through that difficulty. He's going to have to work through that struggle. And it could lead to an evolution or perhaps even a deviation from what he is known for doing. And I think that's, for me, going to be something that I'll watch quite closely in terms of, does he try to adapt almost to the players, or does he force them through that difficult period of transition themselves, where they keep playing the way they have? I know Morgan said before that Bravo was making or waiting for kind of the pass to open up. He's in many ways kind of the archetypal Guardiola player in that squad, because he's so adamant about sticking to the style and sticking to the game plan that he doesn't want to kick it long. He doesn't want to aimlessly boot the ball out, because that's not his role. And there are some players, obviously, that don't have that background, that understanding, that foundation. So when they panic, they deviate from it. Not always intentionally. I think sometimes it's just done out of pure fear. But it doesn't change the fact that it's something that he's going to have to work through. There's going to come a point where the gains in terms of understanding are much more marginal than has been during that first six games where everybody looked reborn, everybody looked like they were a brand new player.
Morgan, you want to have a stab at that?
No, I mean, I think he hit it right on the head. I think that the fact that he was at that juggernaut that was Barcelona for so long, he was at the juggernaut that was Bayern Munich for so long. He's now at City, which isn't necessarily a juggernaut in the English league right now, even though they are one of the most, you know, one of the teams that's been up there 1, 2, 3 for the last, you know, 5, 6 years now. You know, they're in no terms a juggernaut. So he is going to come up against a lot of, you know, do I have to make the changes? Do these players have to make the changes? Like you said, Claudio Bravo played at Barcelona, where that was the Pep style. You just do it. You keep doing it because it's always going to work out. That's how it's always worked out for us. So we're always going to have success. I think if you start seeing more results kind of like today, or more teams like today that are pushing up, playing the higher line and really giving them problems, he may have to reassess it. Mm-hmm. But what does he reassess it to? That's the big question. I don't think that he has a plan B at this point for City. Is he smart enough to come up with one? Absolutely. I think he could come up with something. But will it work? That's the biggest question. I don't know that it necessarily will.
From everything that I've seen with Guardiola, guys, it seems to me that he's not going to change the philosophy of passing. I think that's in his DNA. I think his way of working through problems is to change the shape of the team. And I think back to last season, specifically the game against Dortmund, which they ended up winning 5-1. But let's not forget, they had trouble, both him as well as Heinke before him, had trouble with Dortmund's press. So solution to that was change the shape, and he went to what was essentially a 3-4-3. The four in the midfield ended up being a diamond. So he was able to deal with the press by really essentially having no one on the outside except for the forwards. It completely nullified Dortmund. It was probably one of the best tactical switches I've ever seen. It completely caught Dortmund by surprise. So from my perspective, his go-to thing is not to change his style of football, but actually changed the shape of the team, and he gets it right almost always. So,
but here's my question to you, Nahoon, and this is going to kind of expand upon the original question that was asked. He has to do that against Dortmund twice, three times a year, maybe once in a cup final. Mm-hmm. What happens when he has to do it consistently against multiple teams, coming from him in different angles, teams that will catch on to that? That I think that's the biggest question that people had about Guardiola when he came into the Premier League was, okay, you know, if, and again, England isn't necessarily known for its tactical genius, but if these teams now that have all these tactical managers start figuring this out and he has to change his plan every week, can he do it? And I think that, you know, that will remain to be seen until the end of the season.
And I would argue, just going along with my argument, which is that he changes the shape, I think he can, because he played that Bayern team in a 4-5-1. He played them in basically a narrow 4-6, I would call it, where essentially Shaqiri and Alonso and Götze were playing behind Müller and Lewandowski. And I think he has solutions. Within games, he's able to change these things. So I think, maybe it's my bias, but I think he will find the solutions to these problems across teams and across different challenges, but he does need time. And it comes back to the fact that he needs to get used to the Premier League. I think that's the big thing. But that's a great question. We appreciate that. It led us into some good areas. Chris Morgan and I watch a ton of soccer. Different games, different leagues, different time zones. Because of that, it can all get a bit confusing. Therefore, all three of us turn to the mothership, World Soccer Talk, to help sort out our viewing schedules. Every day, worldsoccertalk.com updates the TV and streaming schedules for all of the major soccer leagues in the Americas and Europe. Everything from Premier League, Championship, La Liga to MLS, Liga MX, Bundesliga, and the NASL. Just this morning, I was trying to remember when my beloved Indy 11 were playing. By the way, they're playing right now. And I went to worldsoccertalk.com to find that. Plus, worldsoccertalk.com is the first website to post TV schedules, often days before the official league and TV sites post theirs. So when you're wondering where to turn to in order to find when your club is playing on US airwaves, make sure worldsoccertalk.com is your first destination. Morgan, let's start with Burnley's heartbreaking loss to Arsenal.
Unfair loss to Arsenal. Yeah.
Burnley started this game pretty well. We're not going to analyze Arsenal right away. I'd like to talk about Burnley a little bit more with you because we've not done that this season. They've beaten Liverpool, Watford, and they tied with Hull. Arguably should have won that game against Hull. Outside of Stephen Defoe, who actually didn't start today, how are they doing this? What are you seeing from this Burnley team that is giving them much better performances than some of us thought they would have?
Well, one of the things you got to put it down to is Sean Dyche, and he's done a very, very good job in his time at Burnley, bringing them up now twice. I think the other thing you got to look at is kind of what everybody is really praising Spurs for is the cohesion in the team. I mean, he's done a very good job at, you know, keeping the core elements of that team together, trusting his guys and giving them that self-belief. And I think that, you know, this time, the first time when they came up, Dyche, you know, would never be one to say, oh, we're just happy to be here. They were going to do as much as possible. This time around, he's kind of got that narrative, all right, boys, this is the second time we're up here. We're going to show these you-know-whats that we belong here, because you know Sean Dyche uses potty language. But and I think that he's a very, very good motivator. I think that he's somebody that has really brought this team and had them performing well above the expectations that anybody would give them on there. So I think there is a lot that, you know, a lot of the Spurs, you know, cohesion, self-belief, and work and everything that everybody praises them for, I think you can put a lot of that down to Burnley as well.
Chris, along with the fact that he looks like Walter White, I think Morgan's right about Sean Dyche. Not that Morgan looks like Walter White, Sean Dyche looks like more like Walter White from Breaking Bad. But some of the players on there we should talk about as well. Gunnmundsson, Sam Vokes, Michael Keane, Heaton and goal has given them some solidarity. What are you seeing from this Burnley squad?
Industry, mainly. Effort. A lot of the sort of intangibles that I think you almost expect from a promoted team. I think again, in terms of their summer business and such, they moved the needle a little bit in terms of ambition. And the kind of players they went after, but even then, it felt like they were high rollers for a championship side. Still, the fact that Defoe and Hendrick have come in, that's given them some quality in central midfield. I just think the forward line is really lacking for me. You look at that chance, I think it's Vokes has right. The header in the first half. It's something that's said year on year when a newly promoted side struggles. Those are the margins of the top flight. You score that, it completely changes the complexion of the game, because you can apply that style of sitting a bit deep and shutting off the space, but you then have the opportunity to break as Arsenal really push forward and try to avoid a defeat. So it's quite disappointing. I think, honestly, Arsenal were there for the taking. Yeah. The fact that they stuck with Sanchez in a false nine, when I think we said last week, that's not going to work against a team that sits narrow and sits deep like that. It needs to be against a team that's line is higher, that wants to come out, that wants to try and be expansive. For me, that painted all the kind of necessary requirements for an upset, because I just thought Arsenal, yes, they had the ball, but they weren't very dynamic with it, I think.
But Chris, sticking with you again, playing devil's advocate, as I like to do with you, you smarty pants. Are we doing this again with Arsenal? So say this result had happened with Liverpool. Say this result had happened with Man City. Perhaps the narrative would have been, yes, they were dominant, but they didn't create too many chances. But these are the kind of results that champions need. With Arsenal, is it automatically the dark side?
Oh, no, look, I'm not criticising Arsenal. I thought their performance was solid. I think from a defensive standpoint, they were strong. Yeah. I don't think they necessarily did anything wrong. I think, if anything, they came up against a team that, as I say, didn't really stretch themselves wider than the edge of the penalty box, and sat really quite deep to the point where there wasn't a great deal of space. And I tweeted as much at the time to say that that's where you kind of need that Giroud-type figure. You need someone that's going to sit in between that sort of spot, between the penalty spot and the six-yard box, just inhabit there, because there was a few chances where the ball flashed across. So I think Arsenal created things. The difficulty they had was there wasn't someone in that space just to prod it home. Yeah. So I don't think it was a bad performance necessarily. I think you can give them credit for never giving up in that sense and getting that little bit of fortune stroke reward at the end with the goal. I think, as I say, if anything, my point is more a criticism of Burnley to say that I don't think they tried enough. I think they just sat in their shell for far too long to the point where they were content to take that draw. And I don't think that's a very good idea, Percy. Yes, Arsenal have got very technical players, very creative players.
Right.
I think you can still get at them, though.
Let's move ahead to talking about a game that I thought had a very unfair result. Morgan, Swansea's lost to Liverpool. Man. Swansea, we've dismissed them so much. I think the last two or three games they've been pretty good. I thought in this game they were better than Liverpool, if I'm being perfectly honest. The scoreline was unfair. And in the first half, chance after chance for Swansea. Borga should have scored twice with two different headers. The goal that was scored was another set piece. Tell me your thoughts on this game.
And again, this is a game I really kind of came into late because of the timing of it. But, again, I have to agree with you on there. I think that Swansea has come up against the bigger sides and done very well. Again, we saw what they did against Chelsea. We've seen it in this game against Liverpool on here. And, they're not as bad as everybody makes them out to be. I just think that maybe it is something with the management. Maybe it's something that Guidolin's not doing. Maybe it's something that he is doing. But just for whatever reason, or maybe they just had the fates against them, because this is a game that absolutely should have been Swansea's. Borja, it seems like he's been in on several chances, just hasn't, really had, maybe getting that first goal will open the floodgates for him, as everybody says it'll do, like a Vincent Janssen or somebody like that. He's had several chances, hasn't really put one away. Leroy Fair is their top scorer, so, take from that what you will as far as the team itself goes. But I think, this is a team that is better than what we originally thought they were, but they're just not getting the results. Performances are a lot better. The results just are not there. And poor Mike Vanderhorn, man. You saw the tears almost starting the second that ball went around, went around the post. I mean, I felt so bad for him when that happened.
You and me both, buddy. He could have single-handedly saved Guidolin's job there. Chris, I think it's pretty clear now that Guidolin would be losing his job. In a situation where Giggs or Bob Bradley takes over, do you have more hope for Swansea, or are you still predicting them to get the drop?
It's a very difficult question.
Do they have the players to stay up, in your opinion?
My gut says no. I think, you look at the likes of Vanderhorn, he wasn't really an earth-shatteringly good player for Ajax in a league that they dominate, usually, or they're, one of the bigger teams. There's just too much. The concern I have as well is I look at someone like Leroy Fer, who is scoring goals, so you would say is definitely an important factor for them. When they haven't got the ball, he does so little. And for me, usually Swansea dominate the ball, and their ball retention is good, but he's not someone that I would constitute as being a creative passer or someone of that ilk. So everything that I just look at, I look at even the big money signing of Borja. To me, the deals they've made, they're the kind of deals that you look back and say, well, it's no surprise they went down when this was the business they did. It was a risk in the summer from Swansea. Yeah. And I think I've said this before, so apologies if I'm replaying an old record. That to me seems so uncharacteristic for that football club relative to the image they'd built since they were promoted, as being a team that is able to find a bit of value in the market, a team that is able to operate with not just financial stability, but stability in terms of the team. You know who's going to be there. They've got the same reliable figures every week. And everything this summer just seemed to deviate away from that. And I don't know why. It's something I don't think I'll ever understand. Maybe it's the ownership. Maybe it's that change has sparked something. They've tried to be ambitious and gone about it the wrong way. They've pushed the pedal too hard too quickly. Because honestly, I think when you're going to transition, because look, Ashley Williams will retire one day. You have to do it incrementally. I don't think you can make such sweeping changes like that unless it's been planned years in advance. And obviously that's not the case with Swansea. So it doesn't look like picking up for them anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yep. If we had to stop quoting ourselves on podcasts, we'd have nothing to talk about, Chris. when we come back, we'll talk about another four games as well as update you on the leagues around Europe. And hopefully this fire truck right outside my window will be gone by then. Stay tuned for part two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Before we start recording part two, the three of us were talking about Pro Rel. Let's talk about two teams that are about to get relegated, Manchester United and Stoke. 1-1 draw, Morgan Green. Oh my goodness. I'm terrified that you're on the podcast today because I was hoping that I'd get away with talking to Chris
not at all.
And Karthik, and now I've got to have to deal with you talking about Manchester United. Go on, Morgan. Go on. Talk about Manchester United.
Well, first off, the result is not surprising at all, and okay. not for the reason that you would think. Any time that Sparky gets the chance to raise the middle finger at Sir Alex, he's going to do it. So that right there you should have known this is going to be drop points all day. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this is all I want to ask you is: do you know you, Nipun Chopra, soccer genius? What do Etienne Capoue, James Milner, Jermaine Defoe, Leroy Fair, and Zlatan Ibrahimovic all have in common?
They all play in the Premier League? I have no idea.
Other than that.
they both are topics of this question? I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
I'm going to guess that the players have all got the same combined number of goals as Leroy Fair.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Well done.
All that money for Zlatan, and you can't outscore Leroy Fair.
Well, this is what I think, and jokes aside, I think our listeners know how critical I am of Mourinho, but I actually agree with his post-match press conference where he said that this was Manchester United's best game of the season. It was actually way better than the Leicester win, which I think, as I mentioned, flattered the United. The scoreline flattered United. Thought United were very dominant, but guilty of some profligacy in finishing. Your thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, the finishing could have been better, definitely. I think, honestly, for me, the issue is just with Manchester is the way the money has been spent. Mm. And it's funny that we go from Swansea to this because I think in some respects they have slightly similar problems. They haven't spent the money with, to me at least, what looked like a recognised plan of this is the problem, this is the solution, this is the player that provides that solution. Mm. It's very much been a case of, well, we need someone who does something like this. Let's get this player in. And then that doesn't work and so on and so forth. And it also feels like they've gone a little bit name brand shopping. So the likes of Depay, he's an exciting young attacker. Mm-hmm. Great, we could do with one of them. Same with Martial. Some have panned out. Martial, I think, has panned out and will prove to be a value for money signing if you can be at that fee. The likes of Depay, though, even Mkhitaryan, the fact that you spend that money on someone that was so influential and he's hardly been used, really. Right. There's not... When I look back to the peak years for Manchester United, the Ferguson era, if you will, when he bought players, especially big money players, it was usually with a role in the team in his head that he could just drop them into. And if it didn't work, then he could put someone else there and evolve and move around it. I don't see that with Manchester United. It seems like it's just been a lot of upgrades or a lot of attempted upgrades in one foul swoop. And it just hasn't worked.
Yeah, I see some truth in what you're saying. Memphis, of course, will... bought by Louis van Gaal, same with Martial. I think their summer, I actually disagree with the notion that there wasn't a plan. I think there was a plan. I think the plan was to improve, in every position and in areas that Manchester United supporters have been hoping we would improve in. Striker, now, would I have preferred to see Aubameyang or Lewandowski over Zlatan? Absolutely. By the end of the day, I think your argument about name branding also does, it is also true. I think United did go for brand names in Pogba and Zlatan. Mkhitaryan, I think, has a future at United. He hasn't been played at all, really. He had a good start to the preseason, but since then has been MIA due to injuries and whatever is going on in the background. Eric Bailly has been a standout star, in my opinion. He's been the most consistent player for Man United. So there's some areas of progress and some areas that I think need to be improved. And as for the Sir Alex analogy, I think of Morgan, I'll come to you in a second, but to finish on this, I think of lots of players that Sir Alex bought for big money that didn't pan out. You know, I think of Juan Sebastian Veron. He came on to give to win United the Champions League, ended up playing Scholes out of position, and United lost to Bayer Leverkusen in the semifinal. I think of Dimitar Berbatov, who had a few good moments, including one season where he scored bucket load of goals, including a 5-goal thriller against Blackburn Rovers. But Sir Alex got decisions wrong, and I think Mourinho also will get decisions wrong. I think the sample size is small, and we don't know. We don't know how this will play out. Morgan, give us your thoughts.
Well, I mean, the sample size for Mourinho at United is obviously very, very small. But I think if you're looking at the last couple of years of Mourinho, I mean, it seems like he's gotten it more wrong than right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
With his usage of players. I mean, he went out and bought Juan Cuadrado, and he played all of a handful of times, and then Juventus got him. You know, especially I would more worry about, and maybe the United hierarchy won't let him do it, I would more worry about an exodus of these kind of younger players that go on to be better, as we've seen with Chelsea. And I know I bring it up a lot, you know, the Lukakus, the De Bruynes, even guys like Andre Schürrle, who could absolutely be playing roles in this current Chelsea team, but were sent off because Mourinho deemed them not worthy. I think that, you know, if they can prevent some sort of mass exodus and he learns how to work with the players at his disposal, then absolutely they could turn it around and things could go better. And, you know, obviously with the likes of Pogba and Ibrahimovic, he'll be able to find roles for them, I think, if he works at it enough himself. But, you know, is he going to work at it? Does he have the hubris in himself to say, well, this isn't working, I need to change it? Or is he just going to keep, you know, trudging Pogba out there in the same position, doing the same things week in and week out, and turn him into the new Matic? Who knows?
Chris, let's end on this part with a question from friend of the show here in Indianapolis, Brian Smith. Yes, kind of a tongue-in-cheek question, but I think there's some seriousness underneath it. He says United can't handle Stoke's 4-5-1. Will Liverpool's attack make Jose Mourinho, cry or jump off the roof? But I think there's some serious danger there, because you would argue that Liverpool, well, definitely no one would argue against it, that Liverpool are currently favorites in that tie in 2 weeks. But can you see Liverpool completely destroying Manchester United? Because it's possible. That's how good Liverpool are right now, and that's how inconsistent Manchester United are right now.
I think it's also Liverpool, or at least they look exceptionally cohesive as a unit. They look like a team that understands what everyone is supposed to do. And I think that's something that you could kind of level at Manchester United is at this point. And again, part of this goes back to the fact that Mourinho is still very much in the early throes of things.
Right.
And I think you could relate that to a wider point that as a viewership, as a fandom and a fan culture, we've become far more impatient with managers.
Yes, that's true.
We expect the elite to deliver instantly. And I think what we forget is only one team can win the Premier League. So if we have these three or four candidates, that means three of them are going to be failures. But even within that, are they really a failure? Is it a failure if Mourinho finishes second and gets them in the Champions League? People will paint it that way, but I'd argue it's not.
Yeah.
I think in relation to Liverpool and Manchester United, of course you have to say Liverpool are the favourites. That is partly, as I say, though, because they've had that time with Klopp. They've had, I think it's a year. It's a year on Tuesday, possibly.
Yep.
They've had now a year with him to understand what he wants, and also he's been able to bring in the players. He's been able to get rid of some who didn't work. The Sadio Mane signing is a huge shift. It's all those kind of little pieces that build up into a much bigger jigsaw that I think we sometimes forget when we just line the two up and sort of deride one and praise the other based on how they've started this season.
Let's go ahead to talking about the Leicester Southampton 0-0 draw. I thought the scoreline didn't really tell the story of this game. Both teams created chances. Both teams should have scored. Vardy in particular, when he picked up that errant back pass from Virgil van Dijk. Question for you, Morgan. Explain to me why Leicester City is doing what they're doing in Europe, yet back home in the Premier League, things are kind of falling apart a little bit.
Well, and I noticed just from the notes on here, it is in there. I think that, you know, after an entire season of
notes?
Seeing
what
Leicester
can
do, I know, right? the mental notes that you and I right, share, we've had right, that bond. Right, right. You know, I think that after watching Claudio Ranieri and this Leicester team for an entire season last year, yeah, and seeing what they can do, obviously teams and management have prepared for that. Hmm. There were certain things last year that you can't prepare for. Jamie Vardy going on that just amazing scoring run that he mm-hmm. went on, that once-in-a-lifetime scoring run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming into Europe, obviously, is a whole new adventure for Leicester, but it's also new for the European teams. These Champions League teams, for the most part, I mean, you can usually pick out the ones that are going to be there pretty much every year, and they do play each other a lot. I mean, how many times have we seen Manchester City and Barcelona play each other? How many times did we see Chelsea and PSG play each other the right, last couple of years? So these teams get familiar with each other. When you put somebody in, like that year that Spurs made it in, when, you know, just by the skin of their teeth, when they made it in and then had their little run in the Champions League, teams didn't know what to expect. It was a whole new thing. And I think that they are really playing on, at least in Europe, that surprise factor. Back home, again, you're seeing teams that are making adjustments for it. Vardy, I think, has come back down to earth after that season that he had last year, which is to be expected. I mean, right, nobody, you know, he's not going to go, 10, 11, 12 games straight scoring goals. And you're seeing that goal, like you said, that back pass that he should have put away. Absolutely. Last year, that goes in 100% of the time, given how hot he was. Now, start of the season,
you don't mean
a brand
like physically,
year.
You just mean, yeah, the player, right, right.
No, I mean, he's a good-looking guy. You know, he's not, I wouldn't put him up there with, you know, maybe like a Zlatan or somebody
that. Who is your top three? Give us your top three hottest soccer players.
Top three hottest soccer players right now in the Premier League?
Yeah, right now.
Oh, God.
So you said Zlatan's
definitely on the list. I won't rank him 1, 2, 3 because it's a little too hard. I'd put Zlatan on the list. You know, I'd have to put, I would say Courtois. He's a good-looking guy, but he does have that nose. That's kind of
you don't like
Nose. The nose kind of juts out a little bit.
Okay.
I think that good-looking guy. You know, he's a little he's got the afro going on. I think he's a good-looking player. And
no Wayne Rooney on there, right?
No okay. Wayne Rooney. You know what? I'll throw Jonathan Walters just because he's got that kind of grizzled, gruff.
Silver fox. He's a silver fox.
Yes, he is the silver fox.
This is the best.
He is a shaved Alan Pardew.
this is the time that everyone hits unsubscribe on the World Soccer Talk podcast. Chris, let's talk about Sunderland's draw with West Brom. I don't know how to analyze this game again. We had this trouble last week with one of the games. Sunderland came out hard. Defoe missed a chance that you would argue Defoe should score. Chadley finishes an excellent goal. West Brom was actually the better team. And I guess the analysis has to start with how poor Sunderland continue to be.
Yes. The changing, excuse me, the turning point for them is Patrick Van Aanholt's introduction. And he was played as a left midfielder, actually, rather than a left back.
Right, as a left back, yeah.
A slight difference. Now, in fairness, he can play anywhere along the left side. He's done that before, I believe. And I think long-term, it's much better to have him there because defensively, especially when he's in his own box, he's a bit of a nightmare. But when he goes forward, he's very impressive, actually.
Right. He had their most assists last season, right? Or most goals, one of the two, for a long time.
And the thing is with him as well, he actually is very intelligent in his movement. I mean, you look at the goal, for example, he wins the ball back, sprints past Phillips, and then makes quite an intelligent run into the box. So that, for me, is the very faint silver lining for Sunderland off the back of this game, is that actually they've found a position that incorporates Van Aanholt, but also kind of relieves him of his defensive responsibilities. In terms of the game itself, I think, honestly, Sunderland did better up until the goal. That was I wouldn't say a sucker punch, but it did come a little bit against the run of play. West Brom, as a team to watch, they're a curious one. Yeah. It's essentially just give the ball to Nasser Chadli and see what happens. They've put a lot of responsibility on him, and I've watched them a few times now since they signed him. And everything runs through him, really. Anything they achieve usually has Chadley's name involved at some point as well.
Do you think they're better on the break this season than last season, Chris? Because when I was watching them the last few games, you know, they have more options. Last year, it was basically Rondon or Dai. If Berahino was playing when he hadn't fallen out with the manager, it was just him. This season, it looks like they have more wing play. They have Chadli playing in this free role, essentially. So do they have more options than they did last season, West Brom?
I think, definitely. I think it's a great point. The thing with Chadli as well is, if you take away kind of his technical abilities for a second, he's very athletic. He's very quick. He's very strong. I mean, you look even at the goal that he scores. He breezes past, want to say, Dejubodi, like he's not even there. Mm-hmm. And granted, Dejubodi's not had the greatest start to a Sunderland career. He's been involved in most of the goals they've conceded since he arrived. But even still, in a straight foot race, it's impressive to watch. And I think when Berahino can be incorporated into that as well, it should give them a little bit more of a dynamic attack. And you kind of pair that off with a defence that is really mean. It's a very tough back line to try and break down West Brom. It's organised, it's quite deep, it's narrow. I think they'll be safe this season. I don't have any concerns with relegation. I think they might be able to provide a little bit of entertainment as well for those fans, because that's been an issue. And I think it's telling that some fans were actually calling for Pulis' head, even though they weren't really close to relegation. For Sunderland, you can't really say the same. Their defence doesn't look strong. They're very reliant on Jordan Pickford, who looks a very talented prospect. Mm-hmm. And the midfield, again, even with... what was it? I think it was two defensive midfielders. They had Paddy McNair, Jan Kirchhoff. There was still far too many balls going into that central zone for me, just in front of the defence. Yeah. Rondon was getting it into feet far too often for my liking when you name a team like that. And it's Moyes again. It's that difficulty of he just doesn't have a wide variety of players at this point, right. And it's a long time until January.
Chris, why didn't things work out with Chadli at Spurs? Because when he signed from Twente, he was highly rated at that time. He's like, it was a good age too. I think he was early 20s. I remember him just destroying Newcastle actually a couple of years ago when they won like 5-0, I think, at Newcastle.
I was there.
You were at that game. So
I was right behind the goal that he scored.
He was so good that day. I remember thinking that this guy is quality. So why did things fall apart for him at Spurs?
I think, and this is just a theory, I think in part he got stuck in the cycle of being something of a super sub. And I asked this question
once. Lack of continuity then maybe.
Yeah. And I asked this question to, I don't think he even mentioned his name. I asked this question to Adam Johnson once because he had a similar situation at Manchester City.
Did you call him collect? And
did you send him a text? Did you meet him in the car?
This was many years ago. And I asked him, you know, it must be very difficult when you get into that position, because if you perform as a super sub, you almost reaffirm your identity. And yet if you don't, you then slip further down the pecking order. So how do you actually break into becoming that starter? Yep.
Someone like Chicharito had the same problem at United. Yeah, it's a good point.
And I think that's what's happened to Chadli. And I would also argue, partly, I think he's the kind of player that he needs the ball regularly. I don't think he's someone that can drop into a game, even if he starts.
Yeah.
I don't think he's the kind of player that can drop into a game, have maybe half a dozen touches and still do something influential. I think one of the reasons that West Brom works for him is that he's getting the ball so often that he's just getting a lot more opportunities. It's the notion that top strikers take a lot of shots because they're always trying to put it in the net. It's not always the most clinical strikers that score the most. It's the ones who are willing to take those shots whenever they get the opportunity. And I think it's a similar idea with him.
Morgan, I've ignored you long enough. Let's talk Watford's draw with Bournemouth 2-2. Fairly entertaining game. I don't think it was as entertaining as the scoreline might suggest, though. Amrabat, player that kind of goes under the radar a lot of times, has been a bit of a journeyman, played pretty much all over the world, signed for Watford earlier this year, was a real threat in this game, was probably their best player. Talk to me about Nordin Amrabat.
Well, to be completely honest with you, this was one of the games that I missed.
Mm-hmm. So no, that's fair.
I didn't really get a chance to watch it in general. But yeah, I mean, Amrabat is a name that you've seen pop up really kind of all over. He's, you know, again, like you said, I mean, he's kind of that journeyman guy. I think he's got a job. He has a position that he plays. You know, he has a role in pretty much any team that he goes into, and I think he can play that role really well. I don't think he's somebody that you're necessarily going to build a team around, but you know, he's got the quality. And when you have a manager, you know, like Watford, he'll know how to, you know, he's going to know how to use him. I mean, that's really the best that I can come up with.
Yeah, that's fair.
Kind of on such short notice on here. I mean, I'm just looking it up. You're right. I mean, he has really been over the world, all over the world. I mean, most recently seeing him at Malaga, he's been there for a long time and kind of went through that experiment with them. So, yeah, I mean, he's definitely a player that when I've seen him and I have watched a couple of games with him at Malaga, he's played well, but again, he's not a world beater, but I think he's capable of performances like this every so often that make you think, wow, you know, it's amazing that this guy ended up at Watford.
Chris, the game was basically decided by success, scoring the equalizer after Josh King, both of them scoring as substitutes. The big talking point was that miss by Jack Wilshere, but I have to say that overall, I thought Wilshere had a pretty good game in this game.
He did. He's someone that's going to be held, though, to a frighteningly high standard because of who he is. Yeah. And in some regards, you know, the trail that follows him from Arsenal is almost suffocating at times. That said, I think he should score.
Yeah.
I think if it's anyone else, we apply the same logic. It's good to see him playing regular matches. That's the main thing. That will be the biggest benefit for him this season. And I think it just gives Bournemouth a different dimension in central midfield. One of the things, I wrote something earlier sort of in the summer about Emerson Heinemann and his prospects for this season. And at the time they hadn't signed Wilshere, and I said that there's not a wealth of quality in central midfield for Bournemouth. So you would think he'll get some match time. That changed quite dramatically when they got Jack Wilshere. And I think you compare him to someone like Dan Gosling, for example, he's leagues ahead of him. Yeah. He may not have the same work rate or the same kind of ability to track back, but he'll be able to slice open defences and essentially free the likes of Josh King and Callum Wilson, who look like an absolute pair of nuisances up front for Bournemouth. I would not like to play against either. And I think overall, this is a good result for them. And it just points to maybe a little bit more progression from last season. I don't think it will be as nerve-wracking for them this season.
Yeah, finally, a question on Twitter from Pat Divitt. He asked about, will we ever see Tyrone Mings? Sounds like he's still injured. He still has, I think last year he got injured around this time, and they said 9 to 12 months. So we're right about the 12-month point. So hopefully we'll see the defender somewhat soon.
Don't lie to the people. Tyrone Mings is a myth created by our MLS paymasters.
Too soon for that joke. Roundup of leagues around Europe. In Bundesliga, Bayern remained top of the group, top of the league, that is, after a 1-1 draw with FC Cologne, with Hertha and BVB, that is Dortmund, in second and third respectively. Dortmund lost 2-0 away to a Chicharito-led Bayer Leverkusen in a very entertaining game. In La Liga, Atletico Madrid go top of the league with a 2-0 win against Valencia. I don't know why I'm saying love. 2-0 win.
Yeah, dude, this isn't tennis.
This isn't tennis. 15-0. In La Liga, Atletico Madrid go top of the league with a 2-0 win against Valencia, who have a new manager yet again. While Real Madrid were frustrated 1-1 at home by Eibar, and Barca were yet to play at the time.
Actually, can I break a little news on that?
Yeah.
Barca have lost to Celta Vigo 4-3.
Wow, that must have been a game that I need to watch the highlights.
Three goals in the first half from Celta and an own goal from Mathieu.
Oof, gotta watch that game. In France, Monaco stay... In France, Monaco stay top with 19 points after 8 games played, after they hammered 10-man Mets 7-0 away from home. While PSG are currently in third after a convincing 2-0 win over Bordeaux, catapulted by a brace by none other than Edison Cavani. Finally, in Serie A, Juventus extend their lead at the top of the table to 4 points after a 3-0 win away at Empoli, with Napoli surprisingly dropping points at Atlanta. Napoli and Lazio in second and third, respectively. When we come back, we'll have our top fours and wrap up with all the remaining games of the Premier League. Stay tuned for part three of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Guys, let's do our top fours here. On form, I have Arsenal, Liverpool, City, and Tottenham. Morgan?
I'm going to go with a true form. I'm going to go Tottenham, Arsenal, Liverpool, and Crystal Palace.
Oh, and Chris?
Crystal Palace have not lost in 4 or 5 games now.
That is true. Chris, your top fours on form.
Liverpool, Tottenham. Who am I going to go with next? Arsenal. Who's impressed me this weekend? I'm going to say
Chelsea.
Bournemouth.
Bournemouth.
Excuse me.
That's a good spread we have there. End of the season, I'm going City to win, United second, Tottenham third, Chelsea fourth. Morgan?
I'm going to stick a little bit with the original. I'll go City to win. I'm going to go Arsenal second, Chelsea third, Tottenham fourth.
Chris?
Tottenham, City, Liverpool, Arsenal.
Tottenham to win. Nice. I've got a good...
Way to play to the masses.
And player of the week, I have...
Yeah, because Tottenham fans are the mass.
Yeah, exactly. So many of them around. My player of the week is someone we're going to discuss in a little bit, and that's Nemanja Matic. Morgan?
That's a good one. I would say, at least for me, my player of the week was Victor Moses.
Oh, yeah, that's a good shout. Chris?
Who was it? I had this written down before.
Chris, this is like pulling teeth with you, man.
I know, Jack Wilshere. That's who I was thinking
Jack
of.
Wilshere. We just talked about it. Yeah. Huh. All right. I have a feeling you're not taking this as seriously as I want you to take it, Chris. Come on.
No, I do. I sit for hours and think about it.
All right, let's talk last three games. We're going to speed through a couple of them and focus on Hull, Chelsea. Everton, Crystal Palace, Chris, this is a proper football match. There's lots of wing play, hard tackles, 9 yellow cards, 2 strikers who have the physicality and can head the ball in Lukaku and Benteke. Both teams open in midfield, no midfield structure. Old school English football, Chris.
I would like to change my answer to the last question and say Idrissa Gueye, actually. because somehow I forgot this game happened on Friday night. But I do remember watching it and thinking he was brilliant.
Yeah,
he just didn't seem to give the ball away at any point. And you're right, this was a very traditional game in that sense. It was a little bit medieval from Palace, I think. But then that's kind of the way I expect them to play. In entirety this season, it's going to be quick transitions. It's going to be get the ball to Townsend, see who he can beat on the run. And if they can't do that, get it out wide and try and aim for Benteke's head. Again, it's not the most complicated way to play football, definitely. It's, as I say, though, for Pardew in particular, it has to work because he's spent that much money assembling it. And I think, you know, but for that Delaney offside goal, they pick up a win potentially.
Right.
So you would argue that they're finding themselves on the right side of those fine margins. Mm-hmm. For Everton, I think it may become slightly difficult at points this season because I don't think teams will underrate them. If anything, I think teams are fully aware of what Everton possess and what they represent. And while you can't always stop the likes of Lukaku and Bolasie, you can certainly do things to inhibit them. And I sense that as the season progresses, teams that aren't in that top six will go to Goodison Park and just not try to play at all. They'll just sit deep and soak up as much pressure and space as they can.
Morgan, let's go talk about West Ham, Middlesbrough. My thoughts, again, a 1-1 draw, another 1-1 draw, lots of draws this weekend. My thoughts on this were that Mark Noble and Dimitri Payet looked like the players they did last season. Mark Noble was so good towards the end of last season that a lot of us were hoping he would be picked for England. Has not had a good start. This game he was terrific, and of course that Dimitri Payet goal is definitely the goal of the week, one of the goals of the season.
Yeah, and definitely spared West Ham some blushes again at home. You know, I put it out there, you know, Payet is a fantastic player. We all know that. I still think that he moves on from this team, and I would think that he would move on sooner rather than later, especially if this poor form continues from them. The biggest difference isn't necessarily that Payet's not good or that Mark Noble isn't as good as he was last year, is that the team itself just doesn't seem to be as good as it was last year. They've brought in a couple of guys, and it just hasn't clicked for them. And there was always going to be a regression, at least in my mind, when it came to this team, especially with Slaven Bilic at the helm. But you know, there's only so much that they can do there. And I think we're seeing what West Ham truly are this season rather than last year when they really took everybody by surprise. And even Dimitri Payet took everybody by surprise. I think Payet's good enough that even if you plan for him, as we've seen, he can still pull off stuff like that.
Where do you think Payet goes?
I think he goes to the highest bidder at some point. I mean, it just seems like if this continues...
Do you think it's really interesting him though? Seriously?
But I mean,
I don't mean he's not talented, no. But I mean, he's 29.
Right, he's 29.
And he works as a number 10 in which the ball runs through him all the time. I don't think the elite clubs are looking for someone like that at the moment.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be an elite club, though, Chris. I'm not saying that it's going to be an elite club.
What sort of team do you think will bid for Payet? I think that's what Chris is getting at.
Probably somebody back in France, I would imagine. Hmm. I mean, you can't tell me that, you know, PSG, who went out and bought Hatem Ben Arfa, wouldn't put some money down to get Dimitri Payet just because he's a good French player.
Maybe you know, Balotelli and Payet hook up at Nice.
Exactly. Maybe a Nice or somebody like that. I mean, I think at some point, if you're Dimitri Payet, you know, the stuff that's going on around West Ham right now, I think if they really start dropping it, I think that they absolutely cash in on him in the winter. If they do hold him through the winter, I think he's definitely gone by the summertime. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily say that, oh, he's going to go to Manchester City, but I think that there's going to be a team out there with a rich owner that's going to come in and say, you know, this is a really good player. Let's get him and see what we can do with him.
But the thing is, though, I understand what you're saying about some of my PSG. They didn't buy Ben Arthur, they got him for free. Like in many ways, to me, that is indicative of the situation in French football, which is there's not a huge amount of money going out. There's a lot maybe coming in for players to move away from Ligue 1, but I don't think there's a lot. And that's the thing, I saw a lot of people in the summer, mainly West Ham fans, talking about how important it was to keep Payet in and all this. I just didn't know where the suitor was. I didn't know where the potential club was going to come in, because someone like Real Madrid, I don't think he's good enough for them, to be quite candid about it. I think clubs below that, sort of maybe someone like Everton, who's aspiring to get into that top four, I don't think they're going to spend that much on a player that is his age. He's wonderfully talented. I don't contest that. His goal proves just how good he is. But you also need to run the ball through him. I don't think he's someone that can, much like Chadley in that debate we were having before, I don't think he's someone you could put out wide and get similar kind of output from.
But you got to remember, too, Real Madrid are also the team that signed Julian Faubert.
What do you mean?
Remember when they signed Julian Faubert?
Yeah, but that was a short-term loan.
I'm making a joke.
I think those are good points. I actually have to side with Chris on this one. I don't know that a club, that even if someone like Nice comes in, we have to remember Payet. I don't think Nice will pay Payet's wages. And what they had with Balotelli is that Balotelli was desperate to move to get some playing time. I don't know if Payet will be happy to move to somewhere where he'll get less wages and will be a less, less well-appreciated league than the Premier League. So I guess we'll keep our eye on it.
Maybe.
Final game, guys. Let's talk Chelsea's win against Hull City. Hull actually started pretty well, Morgan, in this game. But once Chelsea took the lead, it was pretty much over. And I think I mentioned this last week and the previous week. I think the go-to guy for a lot of Chelsea supporters in terms of a scapegoat is Nemanja Matic. And I thought, yet again, as he did last week, I thought he was terrific in this game. And for me, was the man of the match, involved in pretty much everything that Chelsea created.
You're right. I mean, Hull did. They started well. In fact, the whole first half, Hull was just very impressive.
Half? I see what you did there. Yeah,
yeah, the whole first half, yeah. Nice. They were very impressive. And, you know, Conte got the team in. And, you know, when you're playing Hull and you're a team like Chelsea, at least in their minds, it should have never been like that. They should have been able to come out early and get a couple of goals. Hull are a very tough side to break down. They're very determined. We've seen them go up against some of the bigger guys, and they haven't really gotten the floor wiped with them yet this year, other than that Liverpool game.
Right.
But that's to be expected. They lose 6-0 to Liverpool every time they play them. You know, once Conte got him in at the halftime, I think he gave him the talk, and you really saw it kind of open up. To me, you know, Matic was very well improved. He's looked very well these last couple of weeks. I think to start Victor Moses, though, was the key to me. I saw a lot from him, a lot of running, a lot of direct running out of him. And I think that he really does offer something in this Chelsea team that they need. And I just I was talking about it on Twitter on Saturday. I just can't believe that, you know, some of the managers that have come in since he was bought have just loaned him out that in that way, seeing that he has nothing to offer the team when right. he absolutely does. I mean, he's a quality player. He's not going to be a superstar, but he's somebody who's going to come in. He's going to run at you. He's going to give 110% effort. And that's mm-hmm. something that this team absolutely needs to balance out some of the other guys in there, like Hazard, you know, even like Willian to a certain extent. Willian did not have a very good game up until his goal.
Yeah.
So I think that Moses, you know, I was very, very impressed with him. And I believe he was named man of the match, and for good reason.
Chris, along with the fact that he picked Moses, which, as Morgan points out, was a good decision, Antonio Conte also changed the shape of the team, going with three at the back. I thought that created some good opportunities for them, creating those triangles and midfield that, you know, those traditional stereotypical triangles, if one might argue. And with Hull City playing a little deep and themselves a little bit changed, Mike Phelan talked about the need for rotation before the game. I thought Chelsea, once they had the game under control, Hull City really had no chance after that. And perhaps we have to give Antonio Conte a bit of credit here, because he was getting widely criticized after last week's performance.
He was. I think in a bizarre turn of events, the rumbling on with Mike Phelan, I think, has made things a little bit unstable, which mm-hmm. when you look at the fact that actually his presence originally was kind of what bound them together, and the yeah. fact that, you know, everyone was writing them off, they haven't necessarily been able to turn that momentum into points as much as I think they would have liked to. And if I think Phelan actually said, you know, we've got 7 points at this stage, so I'm happy. I don't know if it's as simple as they need more players. That's the thing.
Right.
I think the issue is also that you look at that forward line, and I was kind of wrestling with it watching the game last night. Mbakani, I thought, was quite good for Norwich, but he was also good for a Norwich side that was relegated. So how good could he have realistically been?
Right.
And that's my issue, is I look at that squad and I don't see huge amounts of quality. I see players that could have a good week every now and again, but not someone that could be sustained for them. And I honestly think they're likely to go down. I think if I'm picking teams to go down now, Hull are a prime candidate. Just because I think that bright star that they did have, I think it was very much a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you there. I think all of us, maybe it was just the fact that there were only 10 to 11, 12 players available that created that siege mentality. And now that they've got through that period of difficult games, although of course Chelsea was a difficult game as well, maybe the adrenaline has run out, and they've sort of, the real cracks have started to appear. And as you said, the Mike Phelan issue is hurting them, because you would argue that Mike Phelan would have accepted whatever they offered him, but apparently he said no to the first round of negotiations. And I think that does have a knock-on effect on the rest of the team. I think that's a good... that's not, because Morgan, you have some... our regular stat man, as you used to be on the podcast some eons ago. You have some research you did for once, Morgan. Hit us with it.
For once I did some research, yeah. And this is something that is kind of...
it's been a running thing going for the Chelsea support this as this has started, kind of Antonio Conte, how things have improved from Jose Mourinho on there. And I'm kind of running my own little kind of live table here to see how he does stack up, not just necessarily to last year, but in general. I went out and I actually took since Abramovich took over and Jose Mourinho was appointed in, I went out and got the managers ever since then going fresh into a new season with this team and kind of how they've been doing, how they were doing. I've done it up to 7 games at this point. I'm going to be doing it as the season goes on. 2 of them, obviously, Scolari and Villas-Boas. I'm going to have to stop with them once they got fired. But, you know, just looking at everything with Conte, when you look at it in the context of overall with a new manager coming into the side, he's actually done very poorly comparing him against all those other guys like Mourinho 1 and 2.0, Villas-Boas, Ancelotti, and Scolari. He's got the fewest wins with Mourinho 2.0, lowest points, most goals conceded. He's a little, you know, he's over Jose because we all know Jose wasn't all about the goals. But it's when you look at it compared to last year, it's absolutely roses. And I'm wondering how, you know, if Conte's measuring stick is just do better than last year, or is it? We need him, you know, it's a good thing that it's just last year, because if it was compared to all the other managers, he probably would have been sacked by now. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I found out, or that not that I found out, but that you can put kind of in Conte, not necessarily his favor, but that it's hindering him, is that he's really the first manager to come into this Chelsea team that did not have that legendary spine that Chelsea had. He doesn't have Peter Cech. He does have John Terry, but he's been injured. He doesn't have Lampard. He doesn't have Drogba. So this really is kind of signifying the new era for Chelsea. So I've gone through and I've just kind of run a bunch of the just running the numbers on here just to see how this new era is going. Given that he hasn't had all those, I'd say that he's done very, very well, especially considered to last year. I mean, he's already 5 points ahead of where Mourinho was. But the fact that if you're going to put him up against the big boys like Ancelotti and Mourinho 1.0, he's actually fared pretty poorly. And I think it's interesting that, you know, as fickle as Chelsea fans can be, the fact that they are so hung up, the fact that they are so hung up on him right now and that, you know, he is very, very happy. That they're happy with kind of where he's at right now, considering, you know, 5-6 years ago, if this was Andre Villas-Boas starting for his head, I think it's definitely an interesting way to look at it.
What do you know? Maybe Chelsea fans are
Chelsea fans are growing, baby.
Look at that. Look at that.
We can all learn a thing here and there.
Once they switch to supporting, you know, whoever wins this year. Right now, they're supporting Leicester, so there's that fact.
Don't act like there aren't any City fans in the United group now.
It's a fact. All right, boys. It's good talking to you. We will be back. We probably will take next week off. Actually, I'm not sure. We might or might not record. But we will be back the week after that to talk to you about many, many important things, including a small, small game between Liverpool and Manchester United. Until then, on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, myself, Nipun Chopra, Chris Henaj, and I was going to say Karthik, but Morgan Green, we bid you to enjoy your football.